Good morning, Woodland Hills. My name is Dan Kent. I'm a teaching pastor here, and today I am a prop manager, as it were. Also, Rob, I don't think that electronic payments happens between satellites. I'm starting to suspect that you don't really understand electronic payments. That's. Hey, I was scheduled to be here today, just so you know. Greg, I think, is feeling good, and I think he's going to be back next week. This was my scheduled time, and I know people care about what's going on with Greg, and he's. I think he's recovering. I think he's going to be back with us next week. However, last week, was anybody here for Emily's sermon last week? Wasn't that amazing? Let me just share one complaint that I have. Emily has preached maybe 3 times, I think. And I have followed her every time, and that is just really hard to follow that up because it was such a profound sermon. And she really gets at some fundamental truths there that really I'm going to just be building on in my sermon here today. Her sermon was called The Physics of Faith, and I really like that alliteration that she had. So my sermon is called Miracles and Microscopes because alliteration is awesome. And I just want to do 2 things today. We're in this series called Unraveling Truth, and we're looking at all of these reasons why people might think that, you know what, I'm going to give up my faith. And there's a lot of people leaving the church right now. And yet, for me, as all of these things have been happening in society, in science, in knowledge, I feel like my faith is getting stronger. And it's just so curious to me that the things that are strengthening my faith are causing other people to go away. And we all kind of feel that way. So we have this series where we're looking at all of these reasons why people are leaving the faith, and we're exploring that, and we're seeing why, no, in fact, those are not reasons to leave the faith. In fact, if anything, they're reasons to trust God more. And so today I'm going to look at faith in science. And originally, my first draft of this was like 3 hours, and so I, at some point, I just got to do just a couple things. So I just want to do 2 things in this sermon. The first thing I want to do is I want to look at this perceived divide between faith and science. There's this perception that faith and science are at odds with one another, and this has been happening for about 400 years. And I think that today, February 26th, I think, is the day that we should heal this divide. Right here from this stage, we're going to heal the faith and science divide. Okay, I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek, but the fact is that I care about this because this perceived divide between faith and science is just so unnecessary. In fact, what I'm going to argue is that to even say I'm leaving faith for science is to profoundly misunderstand both faith and science. And so that's the first thing that I want to look at today. The second thing I want to do from the stage here is to just humbly perform a miracle. No, I want to show you something that I think is a miracle, and it's something that has really transformed my life over the last couple decades. And I've been waiting for an opportunity to share it, and today is the day. So that is my plan. But before kind of talking about healing the divide between faith and science, I want to talk just a minute about what might have caused this divide. And I'm going to get a little sloppy with the history here because I just want to show a point. And so when I think back on like the time of Aristotle and Thales, and when you read some of their writings, you know, they asked a lot of different questions about reality than we ask today. They asked all sorts of stuff. Like if they came upon something that was interesting looking out while they're going for a walk, they would ask all sorts of questions about the thing itself, sort of bottom-up questions about whatever it is that they found on the path. And so they asked these bottom-up questions. And so these would be things like, what is it? What is it made of? How did it get here in front of me? How old is it? They would ask that those kinds of things. But then they would also ask these sort of top-down questions. And these top-down questions were things like, what is it for? How might I use it? Was it designed or did it just fall from a tree? Is this the best version of the thing that I'm seeing? Things like that. And just a totally more complex way of looking at the world. And some of the things that they talked about when they talked about things, it got a little strange, and they were probably pretty profoundly wrong about their assumptions about the things that they encountered. But at the same time, there was something, when you read their writing, that was very rich and dynamic and beautiful about the world that they encountered by asking all of these questions. And I share all of this simply because that sort of curiosity and enthusiasm about the world, over the years, it seemed to sort of fizzle out a little bit. And by 1600, some prominent thinkers were starting to say things like, you know, it just seems like we're not coming up with a lot of new stuff anymore. It seems like we're not having the same amount of discoveries as we used to. And, you know, people are still writing books because you can't stop people from writing books, even when they have nothing to say. But the books don't have anything to say. They're just repeating the same things over and over and over again. And so some of these thinkers were starting to ask, why? What happened to that fire? What happened to that curiosity? How do we get that fire back? And the answer came from Bacon. Not that kind of Bacon. Francis Bacon, it's a philosophy joke, it's a classic. Francis Bacon, he noticed that, you know, it seems like there are these forces that are keeping science from really blossoming, from keeping discovery from really blossoming. And he noticed that the church was sort of bullying people into believing that reality was a certain way. So there was this top-down bullying coming from the church that was keeping people from making certain discoveries, making certain claims. They were sanitizing everything that scientists were discovering. And that was definitely keeping new discoveries and new kind of epiphanies from going. But also, in common society, superstitions were just running rampant. There were superstitious beliefs about all sorts of things. And Bacon writes in his book, 1605, it's called The Advancement of Learning. And I had his quote, but it's too flowery and too long, so I'm just going to paraphrase it. He basically says that, look, us scientists, we toil to try to understand the world. We toil and we toil, and right when we come upon a new thing and we encounter some new mystery, it seems like every time we do that, some religious bozo jumps onto the scene and says, God does that, that's God, God does that, that's God. And so when you ask, why is the sky rumbling? God's doing that. God's angry. What is that flashing in the sky? That's God. Why did that boy fall to the ground and start convulsing? Oh, he's demon-possessed. How did the water get up into the sky and now it's raining down upon us? God put it up there and now he's dropping it on us. Can you see how there's one answer to every question? There's something spiritual. It's God. It's something up there. It's the same answer to every question. And can you see how that might interrupt the pursuit of new knowledge? And no wonder Bacon said that progress has stagnated. What was happening, Bacon said, is that believers were letting their top-down kind of abstract beliefs sabotage new discovery. And I think Bacon was right. And part of the reason why I think Bacon is right is because I have been that interrupting bozo. I have been that guy. When I was a new believer, and I was still just like enthralled with God, and I had very simple understandings of the Bible, I held some pretty preposterous propositions about reality just to defend this top-down, silly interpretation of the Old Testament that I had. And so I even, and there's a lot of these, but I'll just share one, because this is kind of embarrassing, but I even seriously entertain this idea that God, to make the earth look older than it really is, placed dinosaur bones in the earth so that when we found them, we would think that the earth was older. And this was a test of faith. Do you believe the science or do you believe the Bible? And I thought that never mind that would fly in the face of the trustworthy, faithful, forthright, honest God that I had given my life to. And never mind that it challenged God's character, I was obsessed with protecting this silly top-down hermeneutic, this interpretation of the Old Testament. And so for me, by the way, I'm so grateful for Emily for sharing that she was also reading creationist magazines. It's just made me feel like I'm not alone. Thank you for that. But for me, I've experienced what Bacon was calling out. I've experienced this stubborn, closed-mindedness where I just think from this perspective, and I use this perspective to sort of block out this perspective. And it's stubborn, and it makes me dumb to these realities. It really dumbs my mind to those realities. So Bacon's proposal, since this seemed to be sabotaging any new discovery, Bacon said, look, all of this top-down stuff, This is all metaphysics. This is all stuff for philosophers and theologians. What we're going to do is we're going to just get rid of that. We don't even need that. Let's just put that way out of the way, and we'll let theologians deal with that. Real science is just going to focus on the bottom up. Real science is just going to focus on physics, not metaphysics. That was his solution. And so leave that to the priests. We're going to let data, we're going to let evidence be our authority, not some stodgy theologian. We're going to let the earth as she is, that's going to be our authority. And scientists really love this. And then, like, shortly after this, this was sort of a slap in the face to the church, by the way. And shortly after this, you had the Galileo controversy, and then later on you had Darwin and about 400 other conflicts between church and science. And now we're in this silly position we're in now where scientists and religious people feel defensive around each other, they feel competitive, and sometimes they can even get downright hostile. And it's sad to me because this schism is just so unnecessary, because I think it hurts both sides. It hurts both sides, and that's why I really want to see both sides reconcile. And I have some ideas for each, both church, Christianity, and science, for them to do to hopefully bring these two sides back together. For the church, I just have this one thing, which is I would love to see the church, and I would love to see Christians, not only embrace science, but to celebrate science. Because from the very beginning, from way back in the Old Testament, believers have often, I mean, always kind of had this view of God that they championed, where God not only blessed nature, not only called nature good, but God could actually be known in nature. God was revealed in nature. In Romans 1:20, Paul says this right at the beginning of his book on Romans, he says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from all that has been made." And believers took this seriously for many, many years, so much so that they had this great conviction, this just kind of default conviction about the world, that the world is full of intelligence and coherence. And it wasn't randomness, it wasn't just the gods playing with us. No, the earth itself made sense. The earth itself was intelligent and coherent as it was. And this conviction, a lot of historians now believe, was what caused the rise of science to begin with. Because this, why assume that the world and the universe is intelligent and mathematically coherent? Why even assume that if there's no God? But this belief that God is revealed there compelled people to believe that, no, it all makes sense. And that motivates us to now try to understand that. I'd love to see Christians reclaim that same infectiousness that shapes science. Instead of always being afraid of science, instead of always poo-pooing the things that science does. Because the fact is that as Christians, our claim, our goal, is to strive for the truth. We want to be truth seekers. And if you're a truth seeker, you should never arbitrarily limit half of the sources of knowledge that you use. You should never limit half of the sources of truth. You should always embrace as many sources of truth as you can. And it's sad because you see people who obviously will embrace one source of truth but not the other. And that can be very kind of cult-like. It's kind of creepy, to be honest. And I'm not going to name any names, but I know of religious groups. They won't even let their kids go to public libraries on the off chance that they might accidentally see a book that teaches evolution. And I just think that's sad because I think it's unnecessary. And it also reinforces this false binary between these two sources of truth. I think that Bacon was right. To understand the world as the world is, that is the best way to understand the world. To strategically set aside these top-down truths so that nature can speak as she is, I think that that is the best way. And if you are about seeking the truth, it doesn't matter what your top-down ideas are if they don't cohere with the world that we live in. And so we need science. We need that bottom-up sort of truth in order to make our top-down truth make any sense or be coherent or be meaningful in any way. And so I think that the church needs science. For science, I would just like to see one thing, and that is for science to stay scientific. Stay scientific. Don't become scientism. In other words, I think Bacon was right. The best way to understand the world and the universe is to restrict our focus to things in and of themselves, to look at the world from the bottom up. That, I think, is the most profound method for understanding the world as it is. So what I ask of science is don't pervert this method into something else. Don't turn your scientific method into a scientific worldview, because a scientific worldview is much bigger. It's a more broad thing. And reality, I will argue, is so much bigger than the scope of the scientific method. And when you try to turn the scientific method into a scientific worldview, you're not going to be able to answer a lot of the questions that you want to answer with a worldview. So for instance, if you want to study eclipses, that's cool. I recommend getting some eclipse glasses. Put those eclipse glasses on and stare at the sun, because that will allow you to look at the sun without hurting yourself. But don't then go and live your life with these glasses on. You're going to miss a lot of stuff because you're wearing these big dark glasses. That's exactly what is happening when we try to turn our scientific method into a scientific worldview. You're taking these constraints and you're applying it to life in general. Yes, fully embrace the constraints of science while you're doing science. But leave those constraints in the lab when you're constructing your worldview, when you're answering big questions like, who am I? And how should I live? And what's it all about? Those types of questions are just too big. When you're constructing your worldview, I believe, whether you're a believer or not, when you're constructing that big worldview, limiting your sources of truth one way or the other, you're always going to end up with a limited worldview. In the same way that I experienced by looking at the world top down through my simplistic understandings of the Bible, it blinded me to the wonders of nature. It really did. In the same way, when science becomes a worldview, this bottom-up approach at the exclusion of top-down truths, that makes us blind to shockingly obvious realities that float just above science's reach. And so that's what I want to look at now. What I want to say is that the methods of science are great, but when they're applied to a worldview, they're too short to scratch the itches that we have when we're trying to build a worldview. In other words, I don't know if this is going to work, but you must be this tall to form a worldview. And science is not that tall. And so I don't know if that works, but it struck me as funny. So we'll go with it. And we've talked about a lot of these. There's a lot of examples of how science as a worldview doesn't scratch all the itches that we have. And I have a bunch. I'm going to just share five of them. The first one is simply this. And Greg has argued this so well. We hunger for meaning that the material world simply cannot give us from the bottom up. And that makes sense, because you can't answer meaning-related questions when you have excluded meaning-related questions from your survey. Meaning-related questions, that's metaphysics, and you've said no to that. So you've put that over here. In order to get meaning-related answers, you have to be able to ask meaning-related questions. So we need to bring that back in order to get meaning-related answers. The second example, and Greg has argued this so well too, is that when we go out into nature, we're struck by nature's beauty, you know? And nature herself can't explain why we think it's beautiful. And that's really weird. I mean, why is it that a weed is just a weed, but when it grows big enough, wow, it's a big tree? You know, there's something about that that nature can't really explain. The third example is that nature has a hard time explaining things like faith and hope and love. And, hold on. I forgot my printout, but fortunately I have a backup. Every year on Valentine's Day, I share this quote from I share this quote from B.F. Skinner. And B.F. Skinner was a materialist, so he believed there was only matter, there was only chance. And somebody asked him, well, how do you explain being in love? And this is what he said. Well, when someone is in love, one of the people is really nice to the other, and that predisposes the other to be nice back to him. and that makes him even more likely to be nice. It goes back and forth, and it may reach the point at which they are very highly disposed to do nice things to the other and to not hurt one another. And I suppose that is what you would call being in love. That is a bottom-up description of being in love. Let me ask you, does that sound right to you? Does a predisposition to be nice, does that account for the hundreds, the thousands of years of music and poetry that has been written in the trance of romance? I don't think so. Does that reciprocal kindness, does that account for the insanity that people feel in their love relationships, even to the point where some people are willing to die for the other because of reciprocal kindness? Are you crazy? No way. Love is way bigger than a bottom-up approach can describe. A momentum of friendly acts. Let me ask you this. If you are in a romantic relationship, would you say that a momentum of friendly acts, does that explain, describe your relationship? And if you're with your significant other, be very careful how you answer that. I don't think it does. I think love is much bigger than a bottom-up approach can explain. The fourth thing is life itself. And in February of 2019, we did this series. I think it was called A Priest and a Physicist Walk into a Bar. And it's the science series. And it was a month before I gave my first sermon here. And somehow I missed this series until this week. And this series, you guys, is so good. And one of the sermons that Greg gives, it's called Science and the God Question. And he gives this fine-tuning argument, which I really wanted to give. I was going to give the fine-tuning argument here because I like that. But Greg did such just a dazzling job, just the best version of this argument that I've ever seen, that I felt like if I were to try to do it, it would be like a Van Gogh paint-by-numbers kind of situation. It just wouldn't look right. And so I encourage you to go and look at that sermon. It's really, really well done. The fifth thing is consciousness. And this is what I want to look at today. And this is the miracle portion of my sermon. Because consciousness, to me, the more I've thought about this over the last couple decades, this has just really transformed how I look at myself, how I look at others, how I look at the world. And consciousness, of course, is that center of awareness that we have. It's the thing that we think when we're looking at things, when we're hearing good music. It's the part of us that experiences all of that. And so the question is this experience, this awareness inside, this little spotlight inside of our head, is that purely physical or is that something that's distinct from our body? And how would you even answer that question? Well, one way to answer that question is to look at all of the points where that awareness interacts with the physical world and then ask a question, can the physical world account for what's going on in that awareness? This will make sense as I give it, but for instance, our conscious awareness, when we live our lives, we see things, we hear things, we feel pressure on our butt when we're sitting down, we have emotions, we reason about things. All of these are places where our awareness is interacting with our brain and our body and the world around us. And so my argument is this. Matter at each of those points cannot account for the conscious awareness that is experiencing those things. Not from the bottom up only. It can't account for it. And so that's what I want to look at. And I'm going to give what's called the unity of consciousness argument. And I'm going to talk about vision. I'm going to talk about the things that we see. And I apologize if you're visually impaired. This argument works with other things, but I understand vision the most, and I think it's the easiest to demonstrate, so I'm going to give that one. Now, you can also make an argument about this using quantum physics. And that's way too complicated. So I'm not going to go there, and I don't think it's necessary to make the point. I think I can make it simpler. But it might get a little complicated. And so here's what I ask, is don't worry about the details. I'm just giving the details just to show a train of thought so that you can go back to and check it. You don't have to remember the details now. It's the result that I think is profound and transformational. So just stick with it. If it's over your head, don't worry about it. Just hear the payoff, because I think the payoff is so profound. So here's what I want you to do. We're going to do this together. So I need you to do a focus exercise where all you do is you just look forward, open your eyes, and see what you see. And notice what you're looking at. So maybe you're seeing me on the stage, you're seeing these two flip charts, you're seeing the background. If you're watching online, you're probably seeing your screen and something behind it. And just take like a mental snapshot of that. And notice how unified that picture is. It's a picture you could hang on your wall if you were weird. But it's just this nice picture. It's not fragmented all over the place. It's probably not even pixelated at all. It's just this one synthesized, unified picture. It's this unity that points to the miracle that I want to talk about. Because that unity, it just strangely escapes biological explanation. It's so odd because what's happening with that vision is that you're seeing stuff because waves of light are bouncing off of things going into your eyeball. And at the back of your eyeball, there's these little catcher's mitts, these little receptor cells that catch those light waves and convert them into these little pulses of bioelectric signal. And so little packets of electricity are just shooting through your brain into your occipital lobe, into your visual cortex. And the point there is that the light waves are converted into millions of little specks of information, and then that is somehow unified into the image that you see. The question that is so baffling is where in the brain is that unified? And this turns out to be really tricky because what we're seeing is this composite of millions of little pieces. And when I was in graduate school, the only explanation that I saw from a biochemical perspective, it was called the grandmother cell theory. And it was this idea that somewhere in our brain, there's this grandmother cell, and it's a neuron because it's in the brain. And somewhere in there, there's this one neuron where all of these bits of information come flooding in, and it's unified in there, and that's why we see a unified picture. That turns out to be problematic as we started to understand neurons, because as amazing as neurons are, why, thank you. I also think it's a good drawing of a neuron. I appreciate that. Thanks. Say what you want about Dan, but that guy can draw a neuron, right? When we started to understand neurons, they're really amazing, but they're also sort of workaday. They're like kitchen appliances, you know? They have these little parts, so they've got these little dendrites which receive bits of information from other neurons, and then there's like an endoplasmic reticulum which sort of manages protein, and then the Golgi apparatus manages the signal as it passes through. The axon is what shoots the little bit of information to the next neuron. The point is that there's nothing in here that suggests the ability to synthesize 100 million bits of information into a unified whole. It's not happening in a neuron. That's not where it's going to happen. Okay, so then the next solution is, well, maybe it happens in a little constellation of neurons, a little collection. Isn't that, it's like modern art, you know? It's beautiful. So now you have this little constellation of neurons, but notice the problem here. Now we're right back in the same situation. But what is looking at that collection? What is it that sees that collection? In other words, if the cluster is made up of neurons and each neuron is only aware of a part of the scene, where is the awareness of the entire scene? Another way to look at this is this. Imagine a classroom with 30 students, and it's test day. They have to take a test. And it just so happens that the test has 30 questions in it. And this is a really hard test. It's a really, really hard test. It's probably a Greg Boyd test. His tests were always really hard. And it just so happens that the students didn't do very well. Each student only got one right. They each got 29 wrong. Talk about depressing. They each got one right. But here's the weird thing, is even though they each only got one right, they each got a different one right. And so in a weird sense, you could say that they knew the test. The class represented all the information. So the teacher could tell the administration, well, the class knows the test. Look, they each got one right. But we wouldn't say that that's what we wanted. That would be a composition fallacy is what that's called. Because what we want there is we want a single point. We want a student to unify all of the information. That's what we want. We want a student to unify, to synthesize everything in that one place. Otherwise, it's a composition fallacy. What we have with consciousness is similar, but it's a little different. And it's different in this way. We have the unification. We have that unified picture that we're looking at. It just doesn't make any sense. Because when we look inside our brains at the students, at the neurons, Well, they each only have one piece of information. So the unity doesn't make any sense. It shouldn't be unified. It's almost as if there is a student or a neuron in our brain that's not detectable from the bottom up. Or another way of saying this is that it's almost as if there's something there that's not material. From the bottom up, which is how science wants to work, we can't seem to make sense of the jump from millions of parts of awareness into the unified whole of awareness. Yet from the top down, we know that that awareness is real. We know that that unity is real because we experience it all the time. And that is the unity of consciousness argument. And I just think it's so compelling. And there have been some responses to it. There's some common ones that I hear. The first one is that, well, Dan, the brain is very complex. And that's true, it is. There are 100 billion neurons in your brain, and they each connect with one another, and there's like 1,000 trillion synaptic connections going on in there. But a fallacy is a fallacy. Whether you have 30 kids in that classroom or 300 billion kids in that classroom, if the thinking is fallacious, it's fallacious no matter how many kids are in there. Adding more complexity, that's just adding Christmas decorations on a tree that isn't there. That's all it is. The complexity doesn't solve this problem. The second response that I hear is that, well, maybe that unity is an illusion. It's not. There's not really a unity there. We just think there's a unity there. Okay, that seems like it might solve the problem, but it doesn't. It just moves the problem. It changes the language of the problem, because now I want to ask, where in my brain am I being duped? Where am I imagining unity where there isn't any? You're back to the same neuronal problem. And so in this weird sense, the illusion of unity and actual unity reveal the same underlying composition fallacy problem. The third response I hear is that, well, we just need more evidence. And this is the first response I heard to it. I was in graduate school, and I was friends with John, who was a cognitive behavior student, and so he was really into the neurology stuff. And I shared this with him, and he was compelled by it, but he said, well, we'll just have to see what kind of evidence we find. And I just thought that that was so curious, because we have evidence. We have more evidence about the unity of our consciousness than anything else in the world. We have perpetual, nonstop evidence. What are you going to find in a microscope that you're not experiencing all day, all the time, 24 hours? When you look into the microscope, you're already assuming the reality of the thing that's looking in the microscope. More evidence, we don't need any more evidence. And here's the other thing. If you can't trust the evidence that's right here, you're never going to trust any evidence that's way down at the bottom of a microscope. We have that evidence that we need. It's not like if you ask the question, what's on the outside of space? We don't know. We need more evidence because we don't know what's out at the edge of space. We haven't broken through to the other side there yet. But when it comes to consciousness, the problem is that we have broken through. We are in this unified space that matter cannot account for, and we're trying to make sense of that. We have all the evidence that we need. The more that I've meditated on this, the more I've realized that if this is right, and I think it is, then every moment that I experience, when I wake up in the morning to a sunrise, and I can smell my cup of coffee, and I can hear those birds chirping, every one of those moments is a moment that is exceeding my brain. It's a moment that matter cannot account for. In that way, even though science and this bottom-up cult where you can only look at from the bottom up, that will dumb our eyes to the reality of consciousness, but that's just because that's cult thinking. That's all that is. What I realize is that when matter can't account for this thing, that means that every moment is a miracle. Because you can't account for it by matter. Every moment is a miracle. I say it's a miracle, it's not magic. That's not what it is, it's a miracle. What I mean by that is that this is just a reality. It's simply, it's discoverable when you broaden your worldview to embrace both bottom-up truths and top-down truths. When you have a more robust ontology that remembers, of course, all of the dull activities of matter, but is also aware and accepts these transcendent realities that we experience all the time, that we see in the world, when you embrace both of those, then you can see this miracle of self-consciousness as it is. And it's just so sad to me that people oftentimes, they will leave faith for science, But oftentimes in the process of doing that, what they're really doing is they're just exchanging one limited perspective for another one. What they're doing is they're trading their top-down prejudice for a bottom-up prejudice. And I'm so grateful to be part of a church that embraces both bottom-up and top-down thinking, because that's how you get these robust truths. That's how you can get in touch with just the richness of God in the world and in our lives. For me, living, the more I can live in this robust truth where you embrace both, it's just meant so much to me. And for me, this is my rock bottom. Greg started this series off where he talked about hitting bottom. When he deconstructs his faith, when he has doubts, he comes down to these few things that are always solid, and he rebuilds from there. And those are some really good things. I add this to my rock bottom because I can't get beneath this bizarre miracle that I'm not reducible to matter. That is just amazing. And so for me, it's just that important. And I there's so many things that I've taken from this, and I want to just share two with you here to close out. The first one is simply this. This unity of consciousness argument allows us to expand our view of reality, because understanding that matter cannot account for our consciousness, that opens up so many doors, because there's a lot of teachings that don't work in a bottom-up worldview. If you live in a bottom-up worldview and you're trying to be a Christian and you're not considering top-down stuff, forget about things like free will. Forget about things like the Holy Spirit. Forget about things like angels and demons and prayer and immortality. Those things, you can't account for that from the bottom up. You really need to live in this more robust worldview. But the fact that we have consciousness and matter cannot account for it, now suddenly all of these other things are not only possibilities, but because they're revealed in Scripture, now we can trust that these are coherent too. In the same way that my moment-to-moment experience is a miracle, I can now trust the miracle of the Holy Spirit and healing and prayer and all of these things. We've always believed in these things because the Bible tells us to believe in these things. But now, understanding that my very awareness cannot be accounted for by matter, now I can walk with conviction about these other things as well. The second takeaway is this, to expand your view of personhood. Since matter cannot account for consciousness, that means that we now know that each person is more than matter. And I sort of suspected this early on in my life when I was a kid. My grandpa, George, he got in a fist fight with a hay baler, and he lost his arm, and I remembered thinking, that means that he only has 75% of the limbs as I do. It's a weird thought, I know, but that's what I was thinking, and yet, he's still grandpa. He's still fully grandpa. It's not like he's 75% grandpa. He's fully grandpa. His personhood didn't shrink because he lost 25% of himself. And so that to me was just really weird. But it makes sense when you understand that matter does not account for our consciousness. Matter cannot account for our personhood. What it means is that we are not reducible to our looks, our beauty, how many limbs we have, what our abilities are, our frailty, our flaws. None of this stuff is a mystery to us when we have a robust enough worldview to understand it. When we look at people and we realize that matter cannot account for their personhood, now it makes sense to say that everybody has dignity. Now it makes sense to say that everyone is unsurpassably equal. And now it makes sense to understand that God loves everyone with the same unsurpassable love. The scary mystery in all of this is simply this. If you are in a scientific worldview where you're focused on bottom-up realities only, it's really hard to make sense of this idea of equality and dignity. It's tricky because, you know, when it comes to your body parts and your frailty and your abilities, from a bottom-up perspective, your matter, that's all there is. And so when you lose 25% of it, you have lost 25% of yourself. You can go on living as if each person has dignity and personhood, but it just doesn't make sense from your worldview. It's just wishful thinking. It's wishful thinking to say that you could be just matter and yet be absolutely equal to everybody else. It doesn't make sense. When you live in a more robust worldview, one that embraces both top-down realities like transcendence and consciousness, well, what that means is that you and me, our neighbors, our family, everyone that we meet, they're a vessel carrying a miracle. And God's call for us to love one another is simply to act accordingly, to treat people and ourselves as the miracles that we are. And I really hope that you meditate on this, because for me, it's not like a simple argument. It's something that you got to think about and meditate about. And I hope that you meditate about it this week. And I hope that you get an opportunity to talk to others about it as well. If you don't have a place to talk about these things, you can join one of our gathering groups. We meet and we talk about these things there. Shauna and I, for sure, are going to talk about this on the Musecast on Tuesday. That's on YouTube at 4 o'clock. If you have an urgent need to talk right now, you can join some of our prayer ministers up here. Otherwise, we have a prayer ministry online as well. But I just want to say this. I just want to thank you for sharing your miracle with me today and giving me just a little bit of your miraculous attention. And I just want you to have a blessed week, and I want you to treat people and yourself as the miracles that we are. Have a blessed week, everybody.